talking about some appropriation stuff. And what's going on in the Senate? It's pretty interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
The kind of deadlock, trying to figure out how to move forward. You got earmarks, you got authorizations, and then also the news over the weekend with the reconciliation bill, or a reconciliation bill and defense spending.
There's more news about reconciliation.
Russ vote floated over the weekend that the administration would like to use the reconciliation process to pass defense spending.
Just how many new ways can you come up with to undermine how they want to run the appropriations in the Senate? They quickly sort of poo-pooed that, but it wouldn't surprise me if it happens.
Well, I mean, let's just start. I mean, stepping back from appropriations for a second, I mean, you know, Murkowski and other appropriators reacted very negatively to that, right? I mean, they're like, this is not, you know, this is what we do. This is our committee. But isn't this precisely what every other committee in the House and Senate are doing? I mean, if we assume reconciliation and the purpose of reconciliation really is a Senate play designed to get around the filibuster, I mean, isn't that what they're doing already?
To a degree.
I mean, it's not like they're using reconciliation for the purposes for which it was designed. They're using it to enact policy change. And the committees are still going to play a role, are they not? I mean, they do now. I mean, it's just the question of what kind of protections and restrictions are placed on that bill when it makes it to the floor, right?
I'll be honest. I don't think committees really do play much of a role, at least not in the sense that like committees have in the past, institutionally speaking, because they're not formally involved, right? It's the sort of chair negotiating with party leaders. And so you have this weird dynamic where committees, like functionally the chair, has the resources and the staff to get involved in negotiations, but the rest of the committee is just sort of like not there. They're substantially removed. And so like, is it really a committee that's getting involved in it? Or is it just like one guy who has a gavel or one?
Well,
gal
isn't that happening, you know, anyway, but so I guess there's two things here. One is either the committees aren't involved, at which point I think my original supposition that we're already doing this for the rest of our lawmaking exercises and the other committees, right? Because if they're not involved, they're not involved. And this is just an extension of that logic and rationale to the appropriations side of things. Or the committees are involved, at least the committee staff, committee chairs, and maybe indirectly rank and file committee members. And if that's the case, is the reaction warranted and justified from appropriators and everyone else?
I think it weakens Senate power, and I think it weakens congressional power. If you're going to take the annual appropriations and stuff them into huge omnibus reconciliation bills along with other stuff, it gives the committee a lot less leverage over the executive branch. It doesn't give them the opportunity to carve individual bills. It doesn't give the opportunity for people to vote no in the party. It's just going to bind them to sort of the party mission even further than they are. And the separate appropriations process already suffers from this. I don't know. I take what you're saying seriously, but it's not like the appropriations process has looked anything like the process in the other committees for 100 right. years, right? It's a different
It's been
process.
One of the few areas that works, right? I mean, or it has worked in the past.
Yeah, I mean, it depends what you mean by works, but it has come out with a functional product in the way other committees have not and other processes have not. I don't think like Russ Vogt is floating this to try and help the Senate function better. I don't think this is some sort of good government move to make DOD not have, you know, CRs or things like that. I think it's a way to get more money for DOD by bypassing the budget process, which is fine.
Let me ask you.
Like, I would assume blow up the budget process to begin with. But if you want to find a way around the hard caps on annual appropriations, the best way to do it is to take 15% of your budget and stuff it in reconciliation where it doesn't count, right?
Let me ask you a question, though, because, you know, my career in the Senate was, you know, I mean, I don't want to say like hostile to appropriators, but, you know, we would do battle with appropriators and committee staff on a routine basis. And so I don't have the insights that you have from working in the appropriations process from the inside out. And is it accurate to say that the appropriations process as it exists today and has existed over the last, say, 5-10 years, is it dysfunctional at the floor stage or post-committee stage? And the committee side of things that actually works fairly consistently, or is it dysfunctional all throughout? Because I think we attribute this complete kind of dysfunction and gridlock that we see in Congress's inability to pass appropriations bills to the entire process, but I don't know if that's accurate.
Yeah, my view is that it's more a floor problem. I think in the subcommittees, you still have, at least in the House and generating these bills, you still have people working together and cutting deals, and like they're the kind of thing you want when you're looking at collective action among legislators who disagree. I do think the stall is at the floor. I think oftentimes in appropriations, the stall is not even over the money. It's over other stuff trying to ride on it because it's must-pass bills. And so fix the process elsewhere in Congress, and the appropriations bills don't have to shoulder the burden of everybody's fight over everything. But I think the process of generating these spending amounts for individual accounts across the government still works reasonably well at the subcommittee level. Not as good as it did in the past, but still not as badly as it appears on the floor, where these things just come to a dead halt. And I think that they've been done a huge disservice by turning appropriations into an aggregate spending game where it's all about the top line number. And then people who want to cut have an easy time being like, we should have a lower top-down number. And then you get to the individual accounts, and that's not credible to cut them. And so people are jammed up, right, with their top-line numbers. So I think it's more a floor problem. It's definitely not a subcommittee problem, especially in the Senate, where they don't seem to want to do anything. But I think when it's time, when they make the deal and cut the omnibus to go, like the subcommittees have done all their work, like the individual accounts get filled in compromised ways that a lot of people support. The idea that that couldn't happen 3 months earlier, 6 months earlier, if you cleared away a lot of the fiery sidecar issues that come along with this, I don't know. That said, I don't think it's perfect. One sidecar to this that I would know is that the NDAA looks like a better spot right now for members to come together and sort of use the power of the purse for institutional tools, like, fencing off Hegseth's travel money, right, until he coughs up that report. It's like, that's like a perfectly good use of the power of the purse for Congress. And lo and behold, it's Armed Services doing it, which is, not something they don't do, right? They do this, but it's funny to see them do it more aggressively than the appropriators even try to do it. Especially because the appropriators sometimes are a little circumspect about NDAA style fencings of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't even think the problem is appropriations, to be honest with you. I think the problem is the budgeting process. And I think Matt's comments kind of hint towards this. It's not like once they have a number, they can figure it out, right? And the subcommittees will come up with some sort of solution and fill the accounts to the levels in which that hit the right number. The problem is that we never get a number. And the reason we don't get a number is twofold. One, like you have intra-party disagreement, so you can't pass like purely partisan budgets. And two, you have inter-party polarization because the two parties have zero incentive to work together. And so what we do is we kind of fabricate a crisis, or leaders fabricate a crisis in order to generate bipartisan support for a number. And and so it's sort of like we're the budget process is broken. I don't think the appropriations is actually broken at all, right? It's really just the matter of, what's the top line going to be? How much for defense and non-defense? And that's where all the wrangling is. Once we have the numbers, the appropriations bills, they kind of funnel out, and everybody sort of understands the problem. There are a couple bills that have like big political issues, but for the most part, if you give the appropriations committees just sort of like a number, they'll be able to work out the problems. The problems really lie in like trying to navigate the partisan nature of the budget process. And that's something that party leaders can't do under the actual budget process. So they kind of fabricate a shutdown crisis or deadline in order to come to some kind of force a bipartisan agreement, because that's the only way you can come up with a number these days.
Was the problem the lack of a number, or is it disagreement over a number, or I don't know, like a sense that the number matters? I mean, if you think back to the Bush years, we've had top line numbers, and the appropriators would routinely shuffle around their 302B allocations. For your listeners, you get your top line and then you have your 302B, which is your subcommittee allocations. They would constantly shuffle those around so that when they would bring up the last bill onto the floor, it would violate or exceed the top line number. And then a point of order is not going to lie. If the Republicans are in control, they're not going to, like, you know, it's just nobody's going to make a point of order against a defense appropriations bill and take it down because it violates the top down, you know, or they'll waive it.
I mean, the point
I
is,
mean,
I
how
think what
binding has the budget? I mean, it seems to me that, and sorry, Matt, that the budget process is 100% broken, but I don't think it ever worked. Right? I mean, it seems like it worked only when we didn't. When people weren't trying to use it to enforce budgetary discipline according to the numbers we set, right?
That's fair, but it still doesn't change the fact that you can't get the appropriations process going until the appropriations committee is handed this fictional number, right? For the most part. And this fictional number is what drives a lot of members' sort of political needs, right? I think it's completely like neither here nor there if the annual appropriations goes up or down by 4%. It has nothing to do with the budget of the United States in long-term fiscal health. It just doesn't, right? We're talking about discretionary funds that are a third of total spending that aren't the driver of like runaway spending costs, can't control taxation, but members live and die by that number politically, and that's fine, right? Voters care about it, maybe. Looks good to say you're cutting the budget by X percent or whatever, but that is a stall. Like you say, if it doesn't matter, then it's a completely ridiculous situation if that is what is holding up things politically, right? If it's a useless number, it doesn't mean anything anyway. What are we even doing here, right? Would Congress look any different if we blew up the Budget Act and threw it out the window? I'm not sure it would in terms of functional outputs, either on spending levels or sort of like anything else. And so I don't disagree that this isn't just the Budget Committee's fault. It's not their fault, but too many members are too hung up on these aggregate spending numbers and digging in to make sort of the political needs they have related to them relevant, and they're not relevant, right? Like no one who's like, well, I'm for a 12% cut in the top line can ever name you 12% of the actual appropriations they want to cut. They just can't do it. It's not possible. They won't vote for it.
Well, that gets to a kind of a point that I'm going to interpret from Josh's point, which under kind of lying it, which is it's not necessarily a budget problem or a fiscal problem, but it's a process problem. And I think at least as I see it, and the current holdup in the Senate right now with the minibus, I think illustrates this very well, right? I mean, the debate over the minibus boils down to earmarks, right? And authorization language in an appropriations bill, not fiscal stuff. I mean, earmarks you could say are fiscal, but that's not the objection. And they're paralyzed. They can't move because they are unwilling to. They don't know how. It's not like they don't know how to navigate this. They're just unwilling to try.
Well, I think these things are sort of linked. It goes to the practices that we use the budget process for, right? It's sort of the budget process has historically been, if you look at pre-2000, a bipartisan process for the most part, right? You have people from both parties who are willing to adopt a congressional budget. And they used to have like bipartisan majorities, and that's changed substantially over time, where all of a sudden it's a totally partisan document, right? And it's meant that only a majority party votes are going to be used to adopt this document. And so it's not necessarily the process, it's just like how the process has been used, right? So it's now party leaders are only going to pass a budget document when a majority of the party is going to vote for that document, and working with the other party on a top line number is completely off limits, right? That's not necessarily a change in process, it's a change in the practices in which we use the process. And I think that this debate over the earmarks is another example of that, right? You have a few members who are like hung up over earmarks and refusing to move forward on the legislation when these bills probably have bipartisan support in the Senate. Am I wrong?
No, I mean, well, I would say yes and no. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a few. And then also, and I think this is a kind of an
so like
emblematic.
Less than 15.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you put the bill on the floor, it'd probably pass. The problem is that the Senate rules, and this, I think, is maybe this is the Senate staffer in me, but, you know, at the end of the day, you have rules, and rules give you leverage, and you use that leverage even when you're outnumbered to try to restructure a debate so that you can win it. And I don't think that the, and maybe I'm just kind of taking something from what you said that you weren't saying, but I don't think that the number of members matters when it comes to the like the legitimacy or the kind of the appropriateness of their stand, right? I mean, I think that's the whole reason why we have these rules, so that they invite members to participate in the process and structure their deliberations when they do. I think the bigger problem, and this gets to, I think what I was trying to get at with the kind of non-fiscal nature of the holdup, because look, in the minibus, we have a number. We got a bill. We got bipartisan will to pass it, but yet it's not going anywhere. And the reason why is that there's, you know, for your listeners, there's in 2019, Senate Republicans voted to make their earmark ban in their conference rules, not the Senate rules, but in their own party rules in the Senate, binding. Appropriators at the time, I mean, not binding, but permanent. Appropriators at the time chose to not contest it. They were like, you know what? It's just easier to just go along with this because we'll just ignore it. It's just symbolic and it doesn't matter. Fast forward to today, in the number of Republican senators who have requested earmarks since they came back in 2021 have increased each year. And it's probably about like half the conference now. But fast forward to today, where you have a handful of members trying to, using their leverage under the Senate rules, to kind of get the rest of their party to abide by the policies that they all say they wanted to abide by. You know, and we've seen this kind of stuff time and time again. And I'm not sure that's the fact that I feel like we're not paying enough attention to that aspect of it. It's like the rules don't matter anymore, which they don't. I mean, that's the problem, right? And when the rules don't matter, everything grinds to a halt because there's no way that people can kind of use them to participate in the process. And we're basically just trying to sit in a room with each other with nobody watching, coming up with deals. I mean, that doesn't get you very far.
Well, I think I have a couple things on that. So one is that I think the rules matter. I mean, they're clearly mattering now because they're allowing these members to stop the legislation from moving, right? They're sort of bottling it up. But two, like most of the members that are in the Senate were not around in 2009 when those rules were passed, right? They should theoretically be thinking of new rules, right? Maybe adopting new rules to govern debate if it's something that they are not, as a majority of their conference, majority of the Senate, going to abide by. If they set them aside or they ignore them, that's another way of sort of saying we're just not going to listen to these particular rules because they don't abide by majority will or whatever it may be. So that's one part of it. But the other part of it is like, you know, the legitimacy of participating in the process is literally just participating in the process. It's not winning, right? And when you start to use the rules to win or undermine like a large a super majority from getting what they want to do, well, then it just sounds less like the rules are actually engaging in participation and more like the rules are facilitating dysfunction by blocking super majorities from actually doing things. And so there's a bit of a tension there. Like on the one hand, like the rules are currently blocking super majorities from passing this legislation, but their participation should be limited to that. You can slow things, but you shouldn't be able to stop things necessarily, right? And maybe they need to go back and just kind of get back to rules reform or something. But I think ignoring rules, especially when there's such wide sentiment to ignore them, is not inherently and anti-institutional, if that makes sense.
Well, Ken and Matt, if I may, real quick. I mean, there. So you have two separate, different things here. You have Rule 16 in the Senate, which prevents non-germane and authorizing language from being added to an appropriations bill on the floor, and you can't waive it. So when a senator makes a point of order against an amendment that has an offensive provision in it, then the whole thing goes away. You could always nuke it, I suppose. And then you also have the Republican conference rule that says it is the policy of Republican senators that they're not going to request earmarks. That's not enforceable, but you know, it is what it is. But there are clear expectations among Republicans that their members abide by their party rules. I mean, we have term limits on chairmen and party leaders and other things. But setting all that aside, Thune and the and Senate Republicans or the Senate can they can move forward with the current Minibus. And the way in which it's set up is that there's a House passed bill, the Defense Appropriations Bill, and the plan is to offer a minibus, which has four other appropriations bills, plus the Senate version of the defense funding bill, offer that as an amendment on the floor to the House passed bill. That's the plan. There is nothing stopping the Senate and its rules from moving to proceed to that bill, filing cloture on it, voting for cloture, getting on the bill, and then Thune getting recognized, and then Thune offering his minibus amendment. Nothing can stop them from doing that. What the rules are doing is that once that amendment, that minibus amendment, is pending to the actual defense bill, any senator, not just the conservatives concerned over earmarks, could threaten to raise a point of order, which would defeat the whole thing if they don't want to nuke it. That gives them leverage then to participate in negotiations over what they want. And everybody has a price. I think the dysfunction arises because the leadership doesn't want that. Rank and file members don't want that. They don't want to put themselves in a position where they're on an equal playing field with another senator, and they have to genuinely bargain for that senator to not tank the whole thing. Right. And I think that's the fundamental problem. Right now, it's like, we'll offer you four amendments. They're all set at 60 vote thresholds. Well, if you have a Rule 16 point of order in your back pocket, you can say, screw you. I want my amendment at 51. And I'm going to pick my amendments, and I may want eight, right? That's not eight, that's five. But I'm going to, I may want more than that. But you have a much more leverage in the process to kind of do this. And I think that's the problem. That's the problem right now, is it's the inability of senators to kind of bargain with each other. And they want to know before they even get started how the process is going to end. The reason why the appropriations process has worked in the past, I hated it when it worked. I mean, you were there. The summer was the worst time, because you'd be there, it'd be like Wednesday at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, because they would just have to stay in and they would grind through these bills. The defense bill would take 2 weeks, every other bill would take 1 week. And they would grind through them Monday through Friday. And they would stay in until they got through it. The appropriations process seems to me it works. And it's that it's inherently something in which people can compromise on. Well, you're at this number, I'm at this number. Okay. The problem is when you refuse to engage in those deliberations, or you refuse to allow senators to create situations in which they have equal leverage to participate in those negotiations, right? I mean, that seems to me to be the problem.
Aren't they negotiating now, though?
Well, it's basically pleading with conservatives, trying to persuade them to drop their, not drop their threats, but to basically agree to a unanimous consent agreement. And look, I mean, just to give you an idea, if
Right, but
you're
I mean,
in,
isn't that part of the negotiation? Like, hey, you drop your unanimous consent agreements if I give you X,
yeah, I'll give you
right? Like,
like two
that's like the
amendments
negotiation.
it's I'll give you two amendments at 60 vote threshold.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's not, I mean, that's something that, that's a pretty bad deal.
I mean, this is like setting aside. I'm gonna go nuclear here in a second, my own little way. This is setting aside. Senate rules suck. These are the dumbest rules in
Well,
the history of rules. Like
real quick, on the Senate rules, they can move to
allowing one
pre
senator to completely nuke a huge bill. Like, it's insane. That's nuts, right? You
why
should be
don't
able to
they just
participate. You should be able to participate. You should be able to have your say. But like that kind of power in a single senator is insane. It's just nuts in this
Well,
day and
they can
age.
always move to waive the rules too. Rule 5 sets out a process very clear. 67 senators can move to waive the Senate rules. They can move to waive Rule 16. Why aren't they doing that? If there is such a
Great question.
broad supermajority, because they don't, it's, I don't think senators even think about using the rules anymore.
No, I mean, I agree with that. I don't think the Senate rules inherently suck. I think that
You're wrong about that,
the
Matt,
branch of
but
the
go
tree
ahead.
they've gotten themselves down is where the rules they're willing to use and the rules they're not willing to use because of crazy norms that have developed in their own heads and collectively among their heads have put them in a spot where they have a set of rules that stop things dead in their tracks, which they're willing to sort of uphold, and a set of rules that would allow them to sort of break through this that they're just not willing to use. I mean, forget Thune putting this bill on the floor. Any one of them could put it on the floor. All right, just go down there and do it. Right, and that is annoying. But on the other hand, like there's a functionalist aspect to it and a consequentialist aspect to it, where it's like, this is what is for many of them meeting their political needs. And you can argue about whether those political needs are good, bad, stupid, or otherwise, but a lot of them prefer this to having to go down there in an accountable way, fight it out in public.
It's exhausting. You got to run. I mean, it's, you're like voting on stuff all the time. It's you. It's it really is exhausting compared to the way it's done now. But when this all got started, when the appropriate.
I do think this is important, though, because I think the leaders like this. I think we know that they prefer to be in the driver's seat in private negotiations. And the problem is the backbenchers like it, too. In theory, looking at this on paper, the backbenchers shouldn't like this process, but it turns out they do. Right? Because
yeah, I mean, if you. Because if you don't know, if you're new, if I mean, look, the muscle memory is gone. And if you're coming into the Senate today as a staffer, as a member, you don't have a sense of how it used to work. So when I first got there during the appropriations process, it was madness. It was chaotic. You would be on the bill all, you know, for a week. And then at the very end, we would have these big manager's packages, right? And they would, you know, just put a ton of stuff in these things. And they're just trying to buy off votes and get consent so they can get to final passage. And sometimes they would approve these manager's packages by consent, but not even write them until or assemble them until after the final vote. And it would be, you know, with the manager's package to be agreed to by blah, blah, blah. And if you, I mean, I remember going in my first manager's package experience, I was sitting on the bench. They just locked in an agreement. My boss had something in there. And I remember a senator in leadership walked over to me and said, "Are you in the cloakroom?" I'm like, "No, sir, why?" And he goes, "Well, because they're doing the manager's package right now." I'm like, "Well, they told me they'd be in there." Like, "No, you need to go in there and look." And it was like all these staffers and a handful of members surrounding a round table. You could barely see over it. And they're just like throwing stuff. I'm like, "That's not in there." I mean, it was insane. And so conservatives increasingly for leverage started objecting to manager's packages. And I think that's where a lot of this stuff started. And then because they weren't dealing with conservatives' demands for votes on amendments, and they were blocking us. And so we started objecting to these things. And then the manager's package stuff went away. And then in response, conservatives would, when we were still blocked out from offering amendments, we would object to language in the hotlines on unanimous consent request that protected these appropriations bills from Rule 16 points of order. But the desire to use leverage was always a response to a kind of a sense or a feeling of being blocked out in the process, if that makes sense. Like, I don't think people wake up in the morning and say, "I'm just going to be a skunk at a garden party because that's who I am and I like smelling bad." No, I think that senators have like a desire to do stuff. Now, maybe what they want to do is just tank everything, but I think that's probably pretty rare. And I think the best way to avoid situations in which they look for leverage to try to stop everything, to Josh's point, is to give them an opportunity to do that stuff and then beat them if you don't like it, right?
I mean, sure, but no one in the Senate currently thinks that that's the way forward. And the leaders certainly don't. The leaders like it right now. I don't know how you get around that. The leaders like it right now. And to the degree that people are going to show deference to the leaders in even some basic sense means the leaders are going to have a huge thumb on what the process looks like. And like I said, I don't think the backbenchers dislike it inherently right now. I think everyone gripes about it at their moment. They don't like it. But like, I think they're okay with it. The freewheeling floor is, I think, a better system that can process stuff faster. But I don't think it, I don't think it meets their needs right now as individual members. And that's not great. I'm not saying that's good, but I don't think, like, I used to think there might be a backbench revolt coming where they would just throw the apple cart over. And I just don't see it coming now. And part of that is the learning issue. The learning issue, like you say, right? I don't think a lot of them even see alternatives right now. But I don't think they're sitting around in private going, "If only we could get over this collective action problem, 70 of us would completely blow this up." I just don't think that's happening. I don't think they're thinking that.
There's a massive political risk with going down there and just like beating conservatives at these things, right? Especially for like rank and file Republicans who maybe don't want to upset like their most conservative constituents by backing a deal that they know needs to get done. Primaries have an outside influence on a lot of people's decisions when they're making these choices. And I don't think it's, it makes sense to me why they would not want to pick that fight with their colleagues, because it just puts a giant political target on your back. And I don't know that you can get by that. It's just part of the, it's been built into the process that we want to avoid these kind of intra-party fights because it's bad politics, essentially, both inside the party and outside the party, outside the Congress.
My other pet theory right now is that hiding behind a lot of this is a belief that the broken Senate is still better for the Senate because anything they do to fix the Senate is almost certainly going to head towards filibuster reform. And that's bad for the Senate because it's going to throw away all their leverage in House-Senate negotiations. And that what's really hiding behind here is the idea that if they fix the Senate, they're going to lose power to the House. And I don't know if anyone's articulating that, but I have to believe some people are thinking it. That all of a sudden they're not going to be able to go, well, oh, we got a deal in the Senate. Sorry, there's nothing we can do. Eat this. And all of a sudden they're going to have real negotiations with the House, and the House is going to win a lot more than they do right now. And I don't think they like that.
Yeah, I
I think
mean, I don't
being
see filibuster
the broken
reform.
place where the decisions get made, I think being the broken place where the decisions in the end get made in a suboptimal way is preferable to sort of the fixed alternative of having to take the House seriously in a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, but filibuster reform too doesn't. I have a hard time seeing how it happens without empowering rank and file, either on paper. Like a non-debatable motion to proceed. I mean, anybody can make it, right? Or by creating new norms. Because if, right now, the reason why people don't just go down the floor and offer amendments when the tree is filled is because they're told they're nuking the rules when they're not. I mean, the number of amendments pending is something that has evolved over time and will continue to change, and Senate can legitimately change it because the rules don't say how many amendments can be pending. But they're told that. Anytime they would any kind of like novel revolutionary parliamentary tactics are contemplated, the response is always that's going to nuke the rules and lead to the end of the filibuster, whether you're in the majority or the minority. And so if they do filibuster reform in a way that doesn't empower all senators, like by giving just the majority leader for like the first time in the Senate's history, real actual powers that other senators don't have, then I think that undermines their efforts to try to stop disgruntled members on the left or the right. And there's a lot of disgruntled members on the left right now from just saying, to hell with it all. Screw you. Because any senator can get a vote on anything that they want at any point on the Senate floor. Right? And that's what they're afraid of.
But I don't think that logic is like bad logic, right? Like they're already nuking stuff at an increased pace right
Yeah, no,
now.
I've been saying this for like years and it's consistently proven wrong. So I don't know.
I mean, the idea that, first of all, the idea that nuke anything creates any blowback from the other side is just garbage at this point,
Yeah.
essentially, right? You can just nuke
The
whatever you
last time
want and
that
you.
was like 04 and 05, right? I mean, that like when they were like threatening to do all this stuff if they went nuclear and the Gang of 14 said, oh my God. Which incidentally is the last time right around then. Remember when Arlen Specter took over the Judiciary Committee? And conservatives were like, you better commit to us that we are going to consider Bush nominations and that you will support them, judicial nominations. And that was like the demand they made of him to get the gavel. Fast forward to today, if they had done that to Susan Collins on the earmark policy and their own conference rules, either change the policy or consistently abide by it as a party official on this committee, they wouldn't be in this position. Now, of course, all the Republicans on the committee want earmarks, I would imagine. So that's a problem. But
I mean, it is wild that earmarks are what's holding up this bill, since like a traditional answer would be like, just give everyone their damn earmark and let's go.
they were doing that like earlier this year, even.
I mean, like it's the idea that earmarks are holding up a bill is crazy.
Yeah, well, remember when we were told that earmarks were the reason why we weren't passing legislation? We need to bring them back to make it easier to pass appropriations bills. I mean, I think that, the earmark stuff is interesting on lots of different levels, and it is very interesting in the context of the current debate between Congress and the White House on impoundments and rescissions and all of that. But yeah, it's just astonishing to me that this kind of little like nugget of dysfunction in the Senate right now, I think it's very revealing. It's very revealing on a number of fronts about what's really happening there.
Well, I think it's interesting in the sense it's not even procedural. I mean, we've been kind of stuck in the procedural weeds here for a second, but the fact that earmarks don't get things moving anymore is almost just the fact that credit claiming has completely transformed for members of Congress. Like being able to say, I delivered this to my district, like does not give you the political cachet that it has. It's fundamentally been transformed by the new information environment, like social media, by the new media, like by cable media. I mean, everything about it has kind of changed. And so, like, yeah, it makes it harder for procedures, right? Just because you don't have the kind of like carrots that you used to have to be able to get people on board, just because the information environment has completely changed. And it's kind of transformed amendments in many ways, right? You're not going out there to sort of deliver a good to a district. You're going out there to attract attention, because that's what kind of rewards politics these days. And so if you're out there to attract attention, what kind of stuff gets really like gets people like amped up and gets you the kind of attention that you're looking for? It's like the kind of poison pill amendments, the t stuff that like gets people really enraged and outraged, stuff that has nothing to do with the bill in particular. It's just something to grab literally a headline. And so in many ways, the kind of credit claiming devices that used to facilitate lawmaking are in many ways like kind of altering legislative procedures and getting in the way in some respects.
I'm also
Yeah, but I
amused.
mean,
Oh, go ahead, James.
oh no, I was just going to say, but it gets back to the fundamental problem, which is they don't want to vote. I think the poison pill amendment idea, the whole, when we figured out in 2008, after the 2007 immigration debate, that immigration was a very toxic issue in both parties that divided them. It was like a handful of liberals or conservatives can't filibuster to block things because you don't have the votes. Leadership's who gets 41 votes to stop things using the cloture process. The way you stop things is that you basically use amendments and you try to create situations where members have to vote on things they don't want to vote on. And it's hard and you got to work at it. And if they call your bluff and they vote on it, then you're screwed because you ultimately don't stop anything. And when we figured out in 2008 that immigration was that thing. I mean, the border fence amendment. I mean, Harry Reid pulled a defense appropriations bill, or maybe it was Homeland Security effort, off the floor, like pulled an appropriations bill off the floor, which up to that point had been a fairly, structured amendment process because of an amendment to fund a fence on the border. And then if you just threatened to offer that amendment, then it would grind everything to a halt. And fast forward to today, that's where we are in essence, which is like you can't, if the Senate would just vote on these things, it would go through. Like maybe the amendments fail, maybe they pass overwhelmingly, but the bill itself would just sail through, right? I've always found that it is harder to obstruct things when the process is moving,
I agree
when
with that,
people
but
are voting.
I mean, but this is the essence of the poison pill, though, right? It's the amendment that has enough votes to get into the bill, but then ultimately will sink the bill, right? You put enough of those on the floor, and you are going to lose on final passage, right? That's not impossible. I agree with you that if we just vote on all the amendments and we're willing to accept the final product amendments in it, but that's not the only way it can go out, right? You can get poison pills in there that make the thing then deal breakers for people on both angles, on
Yeah, I
both
mean, I
sides.
think it's the I mean, they would always strip them out in conference, right? I mean, that's basically the approach. I mean, it would take them all kinds of crazy amendments. And on NDAA in particular, and they would say, like, and they're like, we'll take it. And then you'd ask for a roll call vote and they'd get really angry at you. And because that makes it a little bit harder to strip it out in conference versus a voice vote. But they don't do that anymore. And I agree with you. If you find that like silver bullet unicorn of an amendment that can get 51 votes but can't get 60, like that's awesome. Because if you're trying to stop something, because then you can just stop any bill. I don't know if that's why immigration was stopping all of the progress on the appropriate bills or anything else. I mean, I think it's that the two parties themselves, because the parties are so centralized, because the leaders are expected to be the ones managing everything, the number one rule is don't divide your party. And the idea that we're going to put something on the floor and just see what happens is insanity from that perspective, right? Especially if it's going to lead to all sorts of different divisions. It's going to produce weird combinations. We don't know what kind of bill is going to pass in the end. Look, if they put a minibus on the floor of the Senate, it would like 100% pass, probably in like 4 days, you know, less than that if it was a weekend. But what passes and in what form it passes, now that's an open question. But because the leadership doesn't want to divide their own party, both Schumer and Thune, and because Thune doesn't want to get crosswise with the House and with the White House, we are now in a position where we have to get all of these different players, all of these different kind of places on board with something that they don't all agree on, meeting with just a few of them behind closed doors, which gives everybody a lot of power in those negotiations to torpedo anything.
But that's important, right? Like, I agree with you internally, the Senate, everything you say, but the idea that they're going to go through this process and come out with a sort of whatever comes out of the Senate thing and not have tried to pre-clear with the House and just roll the dice on the other side of the Capitol seems almost counterproductive, right? Like, and because you can't, like, I mean, you can be like, oh, we'll let the House do their thing and then we'll have a conference committee, right? And everyone will just accept their results. But that's like so far off a Goldilocks path that no one can even remember anymore. And would it be great to get back on track? Yeah, but like, you're not going to ignore sort of what's real in the House or in the White House right now at this point. And to not ignore that means you can't just play, you know, horseshoes on the Senate floor, right? You have to have some structure from the leaders.
Yeah, but also as that debate is unfolding, as it's happening, the White House is going to be playing a very active role in it. The House, I would imagine, would also be trying to telegraph and play an active role as well. And so senators' decisions in that debate are going to be informed by these other players.
Maybe, but maybe you just get a majority in the Senate to strip OMB of all the authorities vote and Trump claim it has, right? And then where are you? Then you're just in a deadlock with the White House. I mean, not saying that's not a bad thing. I'd be fine to see that, but I don't know how that necessarily gets the bill closer to across the finish line.
Well, I mean, if they say, if, you know, critics of OMB say that OMB is ignoring statute, I don't know if statute's going to be the thing that reins them in.
Well, I mean, maybe a limitation amendment on the appropriations bills would, though, right?
I mean,
no salary for staff for the next, until he comes around, right?
If you take the critics of votes at face value about how they're acting in blatant lawless fashion, what's to stop them from continuing to act that way?
I don't know. I hate that argument because that's the argument for why are we even doing anything in Congress, right? Why not just say, go ahead, go to it, administration, if laws don't matter? Because I don't think laws don't matter. I think the administration is terrified every time they step even slightly across the law. They're terrified of public opinion and they're terrified of congressional reaction. And they do it occasionally, but I don't think that a unified Congress laying down the law on this stuff would simply be ignored by OMB. I just don't think they would be. But I mean, that's neither here nor there, because the last thing you need to do is go through all this process you suggest just for the president to laugh and veto it, right? Then you're just back to square one. And maybe that's okay from like a civic government perspective, but it doesn't help us get the bills done.
I mean, it gives us a better idea of what can get done. And then they, you know, it's just, it's the process.
No, I'm all for the price discovery of the Senate floor. I 100% agree with you on that, right? And that price discovery is one of the most important features that we don't have in these private negotiations. You don't find out how people actually feel about stuff. But I think sort of the table stakes and the baseline here is that the White House and the House are greatly constraining what you can even sort of bring to the Senate floor if you want to have this process actually get somewhere in the end.
I have a question. So a lot of this, you know, I kind of feel has to do with omnibus legislating, right? We have a lot of different dimensions getting thrown into a single bill, right? And so you're basically stacking majorities on top of majorities with 20 different bills, and then all of a sudden one giant package arrives on the floor. And everybody hates this thing, but they all vote for it because they got something in there. Why do we think that? What do you think is behind omnibus legislating? Because it does seem to be like once you have a giant package like that, you can't keep fiddling with it, right? The leaders believe that they must crack down, they must like zero out amendments, block all changes, limit participation on the floor, because any more issues thrown into there is going to disrupt like the deal, essentially. So what do you think is behind omnibus legislating for the most part?
I don't think that, in my experience, a lot of people who vote for omnibus bills or who don't use all the tools at their disposal to stop them, they're not doing it because they have something in it. I mean, I think that it does, play a role, but they're doing it because it raises the stakes of saying no. And both either from a kind of a funding perspective or from a political perspective in the party, like what, and it further ostracizes them within their party, which I think is really important from others. And it makes them seem more radical. And so it just makes it a hell of a lot harder. I think that the desire behind what drives omnibus legislating is one, it's A, the thing that works. Right. It's like, and it doesn't work all that well, all that often, but it does work when Congress needs to do something. And then number two, it's a more basic desire, which I think is common to probably all bills. And it's that when you see Congress as a factory, when the leaders are the foremen and the rank and file are like the workers assembling the product on the assembly line, they got a blueprint. You don't change that blueprint on that assembly line, you stick to it. And so, whatever they come out with from these closed door negotiations, whatever they work out with the House and the White House, either in all manner of detail or in the top line number sense or whatever it may be, they stick to that. And they cannot change it. And they don't want to change it because the whole expectation now is that we won the election and we're going to like make this factory work for us. And the idea that there is a process that they cannot control, they cannot predict. And they have to work really hard in to get something that isn't going to be exactly what they want in the end is so alien to people now, right? And so the idea of putting a bill on the floor, it could be a 10-page bill or it could be a 10,000-page bill. The expectation is going to be the same, which is the floor is not the place where we engage in a meaningful, deliberative process over that bill and maybe decide if we want to change it, add to it, subtract from it, or whatever. And instead, the floor is the place where it's the last hurdle to be overcome as the bill goes on to become a law. And I think that mentality is ultimately what drives omnibus legislating. That, I mean, there's some efficiency gains, I guess. It's, December, you can only do so much. But they spend all year long not doing anything. And then at the last minute, they've been like, we got to do this because we don't have any time left. And I'm like, well,
Yeah, I
but
mean,
that's the whole point.
I agree. I mean, the point of the omnibus is to jam the backbenchers and to a lesser degree to jam the president, right? Just force up down votes where the stakes are high for voting no, and you're forced to have not a clean no vote. You're going to vote against things you like if you vote no, and they're just daring you to do it. And I think it's underrated how much it's to jam the president too. NDAA could be 11 different bills. It would make sense as 11 different bills, some efficiency gains by doing it as one bill. But look, if Trump wants to do a veto because he doesn't like, renaming Confederate bases or whatever, like he's got to veto the whole damn thing, and then you're going to be ready to see them override it. So I do think it has that feature as well. I
It
do.
also gives backbenchers an opportunity to talk out of both sides of their mouth,
Sure.
right? I
Correct.
mean, for those who support it, they can be like, yeah, I support, I really am with you on that, but oof, we love these airplanes.
Yeah, I do also think that it's important to recognize what we mean by omnibus because it's always in reference to what we think is normal. All of the 12 appropriations bills are omnibuses in some sense. We're not voting agency by agency. We're not voting account by account. Some of that is efficiency. We can't have 35,000 different votes, but some of that is to jam the president, right? He would have a line item veto if we did appropriations account by account, right? So we don't.
And there's nothing inherently wrong with an omnibus if you put it on the, like, if there was an omnibus on, in many respects, having an omnibus appropriations bill on the floor, open to amendment for 3 months would be a better process for individual senators because it gives them a lot more flexibility and it gives them a lot more options in terms of how they want to make changes to that bill procedurally, right? What if you, I mean, if it's all there in front of you versus now you just got the defense bill and you may have, you may want to spend some money over here in this other bill, but it's not on the floor at the same time. But when it's all there together.
Yeah, that is the lockdown feature of the omnibuses too, is that once you have an omnibus, the logic of it means really shutting off the floor because of exactly what James just said. Mm-hmm. You can't have people trying to, you know, have really popular parts of a bill on the floor at the same time really popular, unpopular parts of another bill, because they'll just try to move the money and they'll successfully move it across those bills. And like I say, you can't, in the sense that like it's just bad for business, right? If people can drain out foreign aid to load up veterans or whatever, right? It's not inherently wrong. Like, you can make that trade, but allowing that trade to be made like is problematic from overall passing bills.
And that drives everything back to that top line number Josh was talking about. Like, it reinforces this aggregate kind of policy making approach that we have.
I think it, I mean, so it's also substantially about, like, you know, kind of dysfunction, right? I think a lot of it takes too long to process legislation in the Senate, right? You need multiple votes for cloture. You have to go through a billion different things. If you add amendments to that, it just extends it even further. And so what the Senate essentially does is, instead of like processing normal, kind of like uncontroversial legislation, they throw it into a bill that's already moving, right? And so now you've got a bill that, you know, deals with chip manufacturing, reauthorizes NASA, does some diplomacy and a couple other things, right? And then you throw that over to the House. I really do think, like, there's something to be said, like, yes, we want like amendments, we want stuff, but at the same, and we want legislators to have the flexibility to get involved in the process and participate in the process. At the same time, like, there is a component that this takes so long these days that it eats up all of the legislative time that's available, rather than allowing for, you know, some disagreement to exist and have rather than senators, or I should say, allowing for disagreement to exist without committing to completely stopping the process when disagreement continues, right?
Yeah,
and you're just on the losing end.
When was the last time the Senate was legislating on something and ran out of time? You know, I think it's
they don't bring
the
it
reason
up in the
why.
First place. That's the thing, right?
Yeah, and but the reason they don't bring it up in the first place isn't, I don't think it's an efficiency thing. I think it's a, we don't want people to participate thing. And it's ultimately created a norm over the last 20 years where even if you had an open process, I'm not sure that you would see the rank and file, to Matt's point. I don't think you would see them participating to the degree that people fear.
Well, yeah, I think
I agree. I agree with that.
Yes, right. You can say that. But at the same time, like, why are we not putting, I bring this up all the time, why are we not putting a NASA bill that has 90 votes in support to the floor? Right? Why are they not choosing to reauthorize NASA when it has 90 votes in support?
So when I first started in the Senate,
as a standalone bill, I should say.
You would routinely look to certain bills for opportunities to advance certain things or raise certain issues. And you would fight like hell on those bills. And if you got blocked out, I mean, if you lost, you lost. Increasingly, there are no opportunities. And so when there are no opportunities to participate on bills, you look to any opportunity to be a skunk at a garden party. So if there is not, if you know that you're not, look, if they bring up a NASA bill and I know that the next week we're going to bring up this defense bill and I'm going to act on that, then I'm not going to mess around with NASA. Why would I do that? But if I know that I'm going to be blocked out on the defense bill, I'm going to mess around on NASA and I'm going to mess around on the, I'm going to constantly try. And so the lesson that the kind of the skunks at the garden party take from this is they got to work extra hard to demand the right to participate. The lesson that the leaders take from it is, holy smokes, we can't let anything happen because if we do, it's going to tank everything. And then we arrive at the place where we are now. I mean, I think that the most radical people on the left and the right in the Senate historically have been extraordinarily reasonable. And even when they haven't, they just get tired. You know?
I agree.
I think another thing hiding behind this is that I think the typical senator and the typical member of the House is way too touchy about having to take a vote that's going to fail, right? Like, they just are terrified of individual roll call votes in a way that seems unbelievably out of proportion to their actual danger to them in any possible sense, right? Like, the idea that we need to negotiate forever just to get a friggin' side by side of two votes that are going to fail seems ridiculous to me. We can just process this stuff every afternoon if you want to vote on nonsense, right? That has no
Yeah, the
chance
number
of
one thing
passing.
leaders tell you is show me how that's going to win. And I'm like, well, number one, that's not my job. That's your job. Number two, like, we'll figure it out.
Speed up the clock on the roll call votes in the Senate and just let them have their votes. The idea that we need a weeks long negotiation and then cloture petitions to get the two to get the side by side ACA extension votes that aren't going to pass is just crazy to me. But I do think that fear of taking votes, losing votes, votes that aren't going anywhere, they're just show votes in the Senate, is so strangely out of proportion to what's actually at stake for the members that they fight tooth and nail to negotiate out, literally getting votes on things people know are we've already discovered the price and the price is not passing.
That reminded me, sorry, Josh, reminded me the last time to your earlier point about amendments, poison pill amendments. Was it, I think Lautenberg offered a like drug reimportation amendment to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare debate, and it got pending somehow. It was a perfect amendment because there were 51 votes for it, right? I mean, you could get the votes to add it to the bill, but then adding that to the bill would have taken away Harry Reid's 60 votes for cloture on the underlying bill. So it took him about, 5 days to figure out a way to negotiate that out. But that's a great example of how you can use amendments to try to tank things. But look, that's the price you pay.
But that's the thing. Like, if there are too many prices to pay, right? In this environment where attention is what gets legislators the kind of credit claiming opportunities that they crave, it's too many bites at the apple in some respects, because what you can introduce an amendment to a bill, that amendment will have a different majority pass it than the majority that was going to pass the original bill. So you have conflicting legislators. You have legislators that are now on both sides of the issue. And when you introduce an amendment that gets a majority from a different group of legislators than the majority that's going to pass the legislation itself, then you've tanked the legislation, right? And that grabs attention, that grabs kudos, that grabs credit. There are going to be Twitter profiles blowing this up all over the place. It's going to be spread out all over the place on YouTube. And that is, in many ways, not great, right, for legislating in the environment where attention and kind of gotcha moments are the political cachet of the day, right? Don't get me wrong, like, political poison pill amendments have been around forever, but it does seem like today, when there is any opportunity to do legislating, poison pill amendments always find a way to rear their head. And whether it's a scarcity problem, like what you say, or whether it's just like the nature of the political business that we have, that's in existence right now in this kind of like social media environment, in any event, it's going to create difficulty with completely opening up the process. Now, I say this as somebody who wants to open up the process and believe there should be more opportunities to do it. But I really do think it's not, the reason that the process has been closed down is not because of leaders necessarily. It's because of the abuse of privileges that senators have had, right? The abuse of the abuse of the filibuster, right? Taking it to such an extreme that you're willing to force the Senate to go through 2 weeks of deliberation on a deal that already has 90 votes, right? Instead of just allowing that vote to occur and saying we're on the losing end, right? There's almost like a lack of acceptance that you're losing. Right. And if you don't fight to the nth degree, even though, like, then you are not losing properly. Right. Instead of just accepting the fact that you're on the wrong side of a majority. Right. Why can't you just accept the fact that you're on the wrong side of a majority and say you'll continue the fight later on? Right. Maybe that's too swampy or something. I'm not sure. But it does seem like
it's too housey. It's too housey.
It does seem like the privileges that senators have been abused to the degree that it justifies leaders' intervention in the manner in which they have done in the last 20 years in particular.
Wow, it's a real house staffer.
And you also have people want stuff. right? They want stuff more than they want process, because you could probably build a gang of 15 or a gang of 18 with the conservatives and the progressives. You could probably, in theory, come up with a gang that would say, we will always vote no on any bill where the tree was filled, right? But you can't do that because both of those groups want stuff. They want actual results stuff that comes in partisan bills, and they're not going to sign on to that, right? They do have that collective action problem. Even if in a vacuum, I think you might have that gang on the far left and far right to just blow up the tree filling. But their short-term interest in actually getting sort of policy wins doesn't allow them to do that, because who the hell is going to do that on the side that has more left control right
Yeah, so what you're saying is we need a joint procedural caucus.
now?
Nobody, you're right. It's just,
Call the problem solvers.
Yeah,
you
it's
know,
not gonna
problem.
work.
So, yeah, no, you know, and like I look, I'll just say, and I know it's been going on for a while, but when I worked in the Senate for conservatives fighting things, I left work on a regular basis frustrated that they were not continuing to fight after it became clear that we were going to lose. And I think that I'm not sure that. I'm not sure that it's the reality is that you have a handful of kind of problem members who are basically pushing all of their rights to the limit. And then they're not, I don't think that's the
I
problem,
don't, to
but
be clear, I don't think it's a handful. I think it's a different handful depending on the issue, right?
well, I don't, even it could be all of them. I don't see, I'm not sure there are anybody doing it,
Right.
to be
I mean,
honest
like,
with you.
well, it's just, there's just a lack of acceptance that, you know, that there is a deliberative process. I mean, like, part of this is like, you know, you make the case a lot, and I really like this case, and I want it to succeed, and I want it to be the kind of case that drives legislative procedure, that deliberation out in the open, like good faith arguments are going to bring about amendments and political confrontation and political deliberation in a way that adds legitimacy to the process, right? The problem with that is that even when you have that process, people do not view it as legitimate because they lost, right? They're not interested in legitimacy, they're interested in power. And that is a dynamic that kind of undermines this idea, right? This idea that the deliberative process in and of itself is legitimate as long as it, you know, facilitates participation, and then a majority can pass or not pass it, right? But the reality is, we have a lot of people who, despite the fact that they're not in the majority and they are participating, the fact that they're not a majority is enough to make them abuse their privileges and their rights in a way that forces others to come down and take those rights away, right? I mean, this is a long-standing history of Congress where if you abuse your rights, then you will lose them, right? I mean, the House lost the filibuster in the 1890s because of this.
Feel like that's what happened on amendments in the Senate, though. I mean, like, I agree with you, but I don't think sort of the amending process was out of control with tons of backbenchers just filibustering via amendment, right? And, you know, the tabling process for disposing of amendments worked pretty well. I think it was more the leaders have a very electoral mindset, and they just didn't want to deal with bad faith poison pill, you know, show horse amendments from the minority. And that's different, I think, than what you're saying. Like, I don't think this was like backbenchers abusing the amendment process that the leaders clamped down upon. I'm not saying it's like good, bad, or more or less legitimate what the leaders did, but they were responding to, I think, a different set of incentives than sort of abuse of the process by individual members.
Well, I mean,
Yeah, I mean,
it
conservatives drove Reid to fill the tree, but and we did it, I mean, in large part with immigration. And over time it became a norm. And now it's like they can't even imagine. I mean, I remember when we were pushing it like to just ignore the tree, well, senator and leadership came up to one of my bosses and said, "Well, how would we process amendments without the amendment tree?" And I'm like, "Well, we don't even use the amendment tree right now. You're only using it to block people. What are you talking about? How would you process amendments without the thing that you use to block amendments? It makes no sense." But it's all because they don't want to vote. Look, the best way to deal with one guy offering an amendment, demanding a vote on an amendment, is table the amendment. Vote on the amendment. It goes away. When you're obstructing something in the Senate, the number one rule, don't ask for something they're willing to give you. Ask for something they can give you, but they're not willing to give you. Make them do the work. And then if they are like right now with earmarks, like You can say, hey, take these earmarks out of the bill. They can do that. And their leadership's like, well, that's really hard. I'm like, well, no, it's not, because you have to get unanimous consent to offer them in the first place. You wrote the amendment, the minibus amendment, with the earmarks in them by reference. Take them out and then offer it. You can do that. It's the leadership. And then they're like, well, we can't do that. And that, well, no, you're choosing not to do it. And so, like, I think that's the fundamental problem right now, is that they don't, all they have to do is say, sure, we'll do that, and move forward, or call their bluff and move forward without doing that and see what happens. There's nothing inherent about the Senate rules that are giving individual senators veto power over what the Senate does, other than the fact that senators don't want to cast votes on or risk legislation that they wrote in that open process. So I would submit to you that it's not the people who are using the rules, it's the people who are asking to waive them. That's the problem.
One of the questions I have about that is, are they not asking unanimous consent to get, in your example, to get rid of the earmarks, because the politics of getting rid of the earmarks means that you no longer have unanimous consent?
No, you don't need unanimous consent to get rid of the earmarks. Look, you need them to offer an amendment, the minibus amendment to the defense bill.
Going back to your example, right, where it's like you have a bunch of legislators who want to remove earmarks from the bill, and the leaders are saying, we cannot remove earmarks from the bill because that'd be really hard and we can't do that and blah, 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 blah.
Well, no, it's like, because it's like
the rules can't do this because the politics of the issue prevent them from getting unanimous consent if they remove the earmarks.
No, it's because they incorporate by reference, which is another whole problematic thing. Reference the committee report, and it's all throughout the bill. So that's a lot of work. And it's like, well, you know, you wrote on November 10th, they hotlined the minibus, and that minibus includes a lot of earmarks incorporated by reference in the text. Now, when you wrote that bill, you put them in there. You could easily, behind closed doors, anywhere, write another amendment that is the exact same, that doesn't incorporate. The funding levels don't change. None of that other stuff changes. Everything's the same, except instead of earmarking competitive grant program dollars, they just go to the program. And then, like, you wouldn't be in this situation. The problem is that leadership, they will say, well, we don't want to go through the, you know, they're in a position, leaders don't like having to deal with two different wings of their party. They don't like adjudicating intra-party disputes, and they don't like picking sides. And right now, it's like, who can we persuade to get to back down, right? And so Collins is telling them that she needs all this money for her reelection and all these other appropriators. And they were never for the earmark ban in the first place, but got it. And then you have conservatives who are saying, let's just stick to the policy. But the leaders are saying, well, we'll just get the conservatives to back down. And when they won't, we'll just blame them. But it's like, this situation is easily resolvable.
I feel like it's not just easily right resolvable, different... though. That's the point, right? It's
no, like, from a procedural perspective, like, it's not.
Chaired that you can't have any of your earmarks. That's like a major problem. Right?
Yeah, but is but then is Collins going to tank the minibus amendment with a Rule 16 point of order? No, she's not going to do that. And so the problem isn't procedural. The problem isn't the rules. The problem is that the leaders don't want to take the earmarks out of the bill because in compliance with their own conference rules, because they don't. And they're like, so Republicans are going to be the ones, the conservatives are going to be the ones to blame for using a Rule 16 point of order to tank the bill. When if they took the earmarks out of the bill and went to appropriators and said, if you want your minibus without a year-long CR, this is the price you have to pay. No appropriator is going to stand up on the floor and raise a Rule 16 point of order against the minibus appropriations amendment. That's insane. I would love it if they would. I don't think they ever would. And so, that's the fundamental problem, is not that the rules are being used. The fundamental problem is that the leaders aren't willing to actually take the earmarks out, right? Because the earmarks aren't, like, that's not, the appropriators, it's not like you're stuck between two sides and they're both threatening to do the same thing. And so instead of saying, let's resolve this, they're saying, well, we're going to blame the rules. We're going to blame the members who are using them. When it's like, just take out the stuff that they don't want to be in there and then add it back on the floor if you want it so bad.
I think we should stop there.
I
This has been
think we
a
solved all the problems.
wild ride. James, thank you so much for coming and being here with us. You should come more often. We love having you.
We'll get some eggnog lattes.
Yeah.
Do it later in the day. We'll put a little, rum in something would be good.
Get a little mini bus pass, have some eggnog lattes. Thanks, everybody, for joining us on Congress Two Beers In. We will see you next time. All right.
That was fun.